Are you ready? Here we go. Some have called it the artistic crime of the century. Others have called it the French word le coup, which essentially means the unexpected act. In English, I think we would say, wow, wow, wow. And so on August 7th, 1974, Philippe Petit, the Frenchman who moved to New York, who had dreamed about what it would be like to go between the two towers at the World Trade Center. For 8 years, he developed this huge plan of putting up 450-pound wire across the two buildings and walking across it. And so his plan took him to a lot of extremes, like going into the building as a contractor, pretending he's a contractor, or pretending that he's a inspector, so that he could investigate and figure out what he was going to have to do to place this high wire up so that he could walk across it. And so at about 7 a.m. on the morning on August 7th, he steps out on the high wire, 1,350 feet above, literally 1/4 of a mile above, and a crowd began to gather. And as they began to cheer, he walked, he danced, he literally laid down on the wire, he knelt to salute the watchers, you know, just for the fun of it. And he performed back and forth 8 times on the high wire he went. And when he got off the high wire, the police arrested him, because that's what you do. And right away, as they arrested him, they dropped the charges within a day on the conditions if he would do a performance for the kids in Central Park. So, wow, he walked this high wire. And he said this about the whole event. He said that later when he was reflecting on it, he said, "Death frames the high wire." And I love that incredible phrase, literally, that all around the high wire, at any moment, death was present to him. And I started thinking about our series, and I started thinking about our life, and isn't it true that for every one of us, at every moment, death frames our life? We don't like to talk about it, but life, just by waking up and getting in our cars and coming here, life is risky. There's this a whole bunch of precariousness about what it means to be human. We're not guaranteed a day. There's no certainty. Anything could happen. Have you ever experienced one day being completely healthy and the next day you are sick? A disease takes control of your body. Death frames life. All of us at all times experience this sense of death within us. But the good news of the Christian faith is that new life comes. And it comes and it comes and it comes. But unfortunately, sometimes we have to wait for it. And we are in this season in the church's life that it's quite beautifully that our ancient ancestors said, we're gonna push pause on it for this 6 weeks, and we're gonna slow down, and we're gonna talk about places of death, and we're going to slowly make our way to Easter Sunday. And so in the church's calendar, you go from Ash Wednesday, where you literally put on your forehead the ashes, that symbol of death. And then you go to Easter Sunday, where it's like hallelujah choruses, and there's gonna be a whole lot of awesomeness at St. Andrew Wildflower. But in between that time, from these ashes, this fragility of our humanity to this resurrection, we have this journey, this spiritual preparation, this thinking deeply, this recommitting our lives to the things that matter most. And I've always found that it's just quite breathtaking that in these 6 weeks, I have special time. I have this incredible moment to say, I'm going to become the person I want to be. I'm going to recommit myself to everything that most matters in my life. I'm gonna strip away everything that's unessential and become who God's created me to be. Death frames the high wire. And so today in our passage, there's all these places that we experience this death, right? In our bodies, in our career, and in our dreams, and in our privilege, in our relationships, and in grief, and in doubt. You heard it today in our prayer time, that sense of death, that sense of ache and deep longing of our heart. But today we're gonna focus on one in particular. We're gonna focus on our careers, those places in our careers where we face death. And we're gonna see in this incredible passage that Kate read for us, this unbelievable hope in our callings that we all have received. So in the passage today, Jesus has for 8 chapters been on this incredible journey. He's been healing people. He's been calling his disciples to come and follow him. But then we get to this passage that is quite deep and quite rich and quite hard for us. And Jesus says this just before the passage. He says, "But who do you say that I am?" And Peter steps up and he says, "You are the Messiah." Now you have to know that in the ancient world, Messiah, this was a career. This had a job description attached to it. And for an ancient Jew in the Second Temple period, this meant a lot of things. This meant that he would be a type of king that would save his people. He would literally conquer the foreign armies and set up the rule again. And as you know, at the moment of history where Jesus enters, Rome and the power of Rome is all over the world. And it's literally pushing and persecuting Israel at this time. And so the Israelites of this period, they believed they were going to get a Messiah whose career would literally be a political career, battling foreign enemies and becoming victorious. And so Peter says everything that, Peter echoes what every second century Jew would say. "We had hoped you'd be the Messiah, that one that would come to make the world right for us." And then Jesus says these words. "Then he began to teach them that the Son of Man must undergo great suffering and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the scribes, and be killed. And after 3 days, he'll rise again." And you have to understand, this is like incredibly shocking. We think you're coming to as a king to make everything right, to set up your political kingdom, and you're telling me there's gonna be suffering and rejection and a murder, and then you throw in this little bone that I'm gonna rise again? This would have just been unbelievably jarring for these first century Christians. What could you possibly mean by suffering and rejection and killing? And Jesus, what Jesus is doing here is he's redefining. He's telling us that career that has been set for me, that's this Messiah career, I am going to tell you that I am called to something deeper. I'm going to redefine what it means for me to be the Messiah. So this is the Messiah who suffers, who's rejected. But hold on, because there's going to be a resurrection and new life is gonna flourish at the very end of this incredibly hard journey. So Jesus is the one who goes on that high wire. And what's fascinating about this is that our early Christian ancestors have talked about it in this way, essentially that he became one of us so we could share in his life. So this is the one who enters into all the human mess making, all the death that we all enter and experience life like one of us. This is the God who is in solidarity with us. All those aches, all those deaths, all that pain. And that for the early Christians was incredibly good news that this is the God who knows what we are going through, who when we share our deepest pains can relate deeply to them. Then Peter does what Peter should do, takes him aside and begins to rebuke him. But turning and looking at his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, "Get behind me, Satan, for you are setting your mind not on divine things, but on human things." Whoa, what happened there, right? So Peter's definition of Messiah clashes with Jesus' definition of Messiah. They have like a bro moment of increasing anger and angst at each other where Peter says, "No way, I'm not gonna let you get rejected. We're going straight to the kingdom, Jesus," right? And Jesus says, "No, you're not seeing the whole picture here. This is how it's got to go. I've got to be rejected and I've got to suffer, but hold on, because that new life, that hope is going to come." So you have this incredible moment in the New Testament where Peter's baffled. I mean, I feel a little bad for him, don't you? He only was telling us what everyone knew about what the Messiah was going to be. And then Jesus says, "No, you don't have it right here. You need to think again about what all this can mean." And I started thinking this week that maybe why when I read this passage, I feel bad for Peter is because maybe all of us in a little way can relate to Peter. Aren't we all in some ways like Peter? We expect God to work in certain ways and to accomplish things that we need in our lives. And then all of a sudden, God goes upside down on us, right? Goes all subversive, all underground on us. And we're like, "God, I didn't see that one coming," right? And so we, in some really strong ways, are like Peter. And we're like Peter in the way they characterize him in the New Testament. Remember, before all this began, he was a fisherman. And I imagine that after the scene, Peter's like, hey, I was pretty darn happy just doing my thing as a fisherman. And now you're gonna tell me I'm all wrong about this whole thing. And so you can imagine that Peter has this sense of insecurity, this sense of overwhelmingness of this career thing is not working out, and I don't understand what Jesus is calling us to. But if we can go back to that moment where Peter was first called, Jesus is passing by on the Sea of Galilee. He saw Simon and his brother Andrew casting a net into the sea, for they were fishermen. These were men who were trained in the skill and in the craft, who knew about nets and knew about ancient seas and knew how not only to feed themselves, but where to sell the fish that they needed to provide for their family. And then Jesus says to them, follow me, and I will make you fish for people. And immediately they left their nets and followed him. Now, we read these passages and it should inspire us, right? But remember that in an ancient world, fishing was their way of creating revenue. It was the way of making money. So they couldn't ever just stop fishing. This was the trade that their grandfather taught them and their father had taught them. And so what this was a reorientation of their whole career. It was turning it on end. It was Jesus saying, hey, fish used to be your thing. You are known as a fisherman. But now I want you to flip it on its head. People are going to be your thing and fish are going to be second. So what Jesus does is he takes this career of Peter and says, no, flip it up on its head. People first, fish second. Because throughout the rest of Peter's life, he's gonna have to fish again. He's gonna have to provide the revenue for where he's traveling with Jesus. And the rest of his life, this is gonna come in handy as a skill and a trade. However, Jesus once again is reorienting, helping the allegiance of his heart to see there is a calling that you have. And haven't we all, in some way, on some path that we've led, heard those words, follow me? Or even if we haven't heard those words, haven't we felt that sense of inspiration, that sense of fire in our hearts, that we were called to do something, that we are more than our careers, that whatever we do for our day jobs is not really what is the core thing that we are meant to be and meant to do in this world? So when Jesus says, follow me, Jesus is speaking these words across the century. I love, absolutely love the way you can define this. Career, the shaping of an identity around profession involving skills, personality, and training that creates revenue. And I've learned in my life that we all have to have careers. We all have to somehow figure out a way to create revenue. This is what it means to be human, and no one exists out of this. But a calling now, the follow me is the reshaping of identity around a divine call. Involving skills, personality, and training. Turns out that these things don't change. We all are who we are, and we learn these skills, and we have this personality. But the difference is this. This calling creates value for others. So careers are good and meaningful things. We provide for our family. We get the things that we need. But the difference in a calling is that we create for others, and we give it away. We essentially stop worrying about our own needs and we open ourselves up and break ourselves open for the world. And all of us in some way have been on this high wire, right? Because a calling takes risk and trust. Callings are provocative. They're challenging and they're stirring. Careers are pretty easy. You punch the clock 8 to 5, you do what you're supposed to do, you follow it. Callings are difficult. To break the mold, to do something new, to create something for someone else is often difficult. But in our careers, even the very best of them, even ones that involve aspects of our calling, we find there are moments of death. We find there are things about them that are bureaucratic or that are just, oh my gosh, I have to go to this meeting, I have to do that. But we always are more than our careers. We're always created for more than just punching a clock. The best careers, the ones that you got in for to help people, even those have things about them, right, that feel at times like a death. Like, oh my gosh, I have to do this again. This is not the core thing that my heart burns to do. And so I love what Frederick Buechner said about callings. The place God calls you is the place where your deep gladness and the world's deep hunger meet. So it's where your heart breaks and your feet take you in the morning. Beautiful, beautiful words. And sometimes when I lose sight of my calling, I lose sight of what I'm supposed to do, I lean on the words of Micah 6:8. Your calling is to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God. So the calling, that thing that stirs, that thing that inspires us, brings us life when we feel like our careers are swallowing us whole. Now back to the passage where Jesus and Peter, they've just had this big blow up, and Jesus is about to say something, one of the most challenging statements of all the New Testament. If you want to become my followers, then let them, if any want to become my followers, then let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. And everyone should say, wow, right? This is unbelievably challenging. Remember, Jesus just said, I'm going to be rejected. I'm going to suffer. I'm going to the cross. This is where my life ends. And then he uses this symbol, this metaphor to say, if any want to follow me, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. Now, I want to remind us of a couple things, that taking up our cross does not mean martyrdom. It doesn't mean that we have to live the same exact life that Jesus lived and eventually die on a cross. I am so convinced that we have enough, that because of Jesus, we've had enough people dying for their faith. What we need in America is people to live for their faith, right? What we deeply need is people who embody this way, but the cross becomes this metaphor, this way of service, this calling. So Jesus once again is calling us not to somehow weirdly just die for our faith. Jesus is calling us to live again for our faith. Jesus is calling us to re-examine the allegiances of our heart and put the first things in the first thing spot. So it's like this, I remember reading Stephen Covey's book, and he has this analogy of the fishbowl. And when you buy a fishbowl and you want to get your kids a goldfish because they nag you and nag you and nag you forever, you get like these little kits. They give you like the big rocks, they give you the little sand, they give you those little plastic trees, right? And I remember when I rushed home for my kids, I just crammed everything in there because I was trying to get that fish out of that little plastic bag, and it didn't fit right. Have you ever had this experience? Well, what they tell you and what Stephen Covey says is you gotta put the big rocks in first. You gotta put the essential things in first, and then the small rocks, and then the tree, and that's how it all fits. What Jesus is asking of us is put your calling in perspective. Put your career in perspective and put your calling first. So Jesus is saying, I wanna remind you, you were not created just for a career. You were created for a calling. So in this season, when you feel like your career is weighing you down, where you're feeling the death, hold on. Hold on, because God is asking you and going to remind you and renew that calling within you. And as you place your allegiance in that calling, as you find that incredible high wire balance to it, there's where you find resurrection. There's where you find new life. So then another way of saying this is, if any of you want to come the way I'm going, you must say no to your own selves, put up your cross and follow me. So it's like this, when we are mired and so worried about our careers, there's a sense of we have all these emotions going through us, like I'm not being valued, what I'm doing doesn't matter. We have all these tons of feelings and emotions with that. But what Jesus is saying is say no to all those feelings that are about you, because you are about doing something bigger in the world. Say no to all your fears and say no to all you think you should deserve and you should get, and be a part of something bigger. Because when you're a part of something bigger, like changing the world, all those little things, they lessen. They don't gnaw at you as much. That's where the resurrection is. And that's where life is. He ends the whole passage with these words: for those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel will save it. For what will it profit them to gain the whole world and forfeit their life? So the end of changing the allegiance of your heart to that calling, to that service to others, to creating things for others is life, is a resurrection, is the very thing that will push you out of the lulls of a career. So in the best sitcom made in recent years, Parenthood, there is of the many couples, This is Adam and Christina Braverman. And their whole story is that they have a son who has Asperger's syndrome. And so the first episode with the Bravermans, the first season, you have this heartbreaking scene where Adam tells his dad, "I think there's something wrong with my son." And it's just heartbreaking. And the whole show is this journey of what it means to deal with Asperger's and what it means to have a child with special needs. And they struggle with their careers, what they're going to do and how their family is going to work, both of them, through the whole season. And then the very last season, the very last episode, how they kind of solved their career and calling dilemma, and that the death that they had experienced was they started a school. They start a charter school for special needs kids. And Adam is trying to, once again, the career that he had started in the music industry had encountered a death, and he's trying to figure out, what should I do? What should I do for my life? What, I need a career, I need to create revenue for my family and all that. And he's in the kitchen, and he had started just helping make the meals, and three of the special needs kids are in the kitchen. And it's so beautiful because they had started to look up to Adam, and he was teaching them one by one, okay, how to make spaghetti, and then they how to make lasagna, and they're growing, and they needed to cut some onions. And so he had kind of hyped up, "I've got the way to cut onions." And it's these teenagers who are just like longing to like figure this out and to learn and grow skills. And he has this bag, and Adam takes out the bag and he puts on these swimming goggles. And he looks at them and he says, "Onion goggles." And it's like the simplest, silliest thing, but the teenagers are like, "Oh my goodness." Like, they're like, "Yes, onion goggles." And so they're all putting on these onion goggles and they're cutting these onions, and his brother. Now, when your brother says good things about you, you know you should listen up because your brother knows you better. And his brother says, Crosby says, "Whatever job you take, I hope it makes you as happy as the other day when I saw you teaching those kids." Onion goggles, right? And so this whole point of this beautiful story is that Adam has been thinking and been obsessing over his career, and then through a silly 5-minute encounter with onion goggles, Adam finds a calling. He learns that in the midst of the death of his career, there is the life in giving yourself to someone else. So as we conclude today, all I want to do is bring us to a conclusion through a prayer. So let me pray for you. God, there are many of us in this room who've experienced death in our careers. Whether that's dead ends or frustrations or fears, or whether we just don't know how to start again, or whether we're facing difficult circumstances with economic shortfalls, or whether we just plain don't like this monotonous rhythm that we're caught in. So God, we come as a community and just confess to you all these places of death, all these hard spots in our career. And God, we would ask you to bring new life. And we thank you for passages of scripture that remind us of our calling to create something for someone else, to give ourselves away. And we thank you that in opening ourselves to others and giving ourselves away, that we find ourselves renewed. And I ask you, God, for my brothers and my sisters here, wherever they find themselves today, you would renew. You would show us the power of your resurrection in our careers. And it's in Jesus' name that we all say, amen.